Hello, this is Steve. Today I'll be reading New York Magazine from March 29th, 2026. The Interview by David Marchese. Baby Reindeer exploded Richard Gadd's life. It also set him free. In 2024, the relatively unknown Scottish writer and performer, Richard Gadd, had the strange experience of seeing the lowest moments of his life become the stuff of viral entertainment. His unsettling Netflix show, Baby Reindeer, which was based on his experiences as a victim of sexual assault and stalking, unexpectedly became one of the year's biggest critical hits, as well as one of the streamer's most popular shows ever. That acclaim catapulted Gadd, 36, into a heightened and uncomfortable level of personal and professional attention. His response to that discomfort has been to go deeper. His new, highly anticipated HBO limited series, Half Man, which premieres next month, is about the decades-long, mutually destructive friendship between two men, the slight and thoughtful Niall, played by Jamie Bell, and the brutish and violent Reuben, played by Gadd, who bulked up considerably for the role. Unlike Baby Reindeer, the show is not based in fact, but what Half Man shares with its predecessor is a brutally unflinching exploration of sexual confusion, tortured masculinity, emotional abuse, and the impact of trauma with some dark laughs thrown in. Those are all issues that Gadd himself is still trying to understand, both in his art and, to varying degrees of success, his life. For years, you were doing stand-up comedy, but the work you did was often intentionally alienating. It's not as if you'd been trying to do some mainstream thing. As a result, I imagine that the possibility of enormous success was not on your radar. So what did achieving success show you about the reality of what it can do for you? The interviewer asked. Gadd responds, "The best thing about success is that it leads to opportunity. Fame, on the other hand, I'm still coming to terms with. At the best of times, I'm a self-conscious person. Fame has led to a certain degree of discomfort in the way I go about my life. You always have to think about what you're doing and where you're going. I worry about people coming up to me. They're almost like projections of my own fear. I'm just wired to think in an anxious way," he responded. One of the central questions of the new show, Half Men, is, what does it mean to be a man? That also came up in Baby Reindeer. For yourself, do you have an answer to that question? Gadd responded, "That's a tough one to answer. I remember a press release going out with Half Men saying it will get to the bottom of the question of what it means to be a man. I was busy writing at that point. And a press release comes to your desk. You're just like, I don't have time for this. So I worry that a lot of people are heading into Half Man with me somehow answering an almost existentially impossible question. But for myself, no. I suppose that's why I write these things, because I've always had a void within me that I can't quite explain. A certain hole in the soul that perhaps comes from pressures that I felt as a man." The interviewer asks, "What were some of those struggles?" Gadd responds, "The 80s in this country was a very unforgiving time for people who grew up different from everyone else. That leads to repression, which can lead to broken and damaging behavior in later life. I know it's quite heavy stuff to get into, but there are certainly things that happened in my life that I've spoken about publicly, that I found very hard to come to terms with, due to false ideas that this shouldn't happen to a man, and men shouldn't be vulnerable in this way. All stuff that I've rejected. In fact, being vulnerable or admitting to my biggest secrets has led to the biggest freedom of my life. The interviewer asks, I assume you're referring to the assault that happened to you. How do you achieve liberation through making art about personal trauma? Gad's response, the shame and fear and guilt and all the feelings around complicity or feeling like an idiot was a big part of the battle that I faced. I built to intolerable levels. It built to intolerable levels where I felt all I was doing was whipping a billiard ball around my head over and over again, to the point where it was just ricocheting harder each time. I couldn't keep it in any longer. The first thing I ever did before I spoke to anyone about it was I wrote it down. I think what art has always done is given me a playground to explore things that I'm struggling with. I'm sure toxic masculinity is a word that people are going to synonymize with the show. For something to be toxic, like drugs are toxic, they have to be intoxicating. Normalization of these things that were so casually thrown around in the 80s, like slurs, leads to a repression in people who are scared to admit certain things. The interviewer asks, is there anything about yourself that you're still scared to admit? Gad's response, probably. I've always been quite confused sexually. Even as I sit here, 36 years old, I still sometimes feel confused. I've tried many labels in my life, and the labels never brought me any sort of comfort. Comfort comes from within. No external answer exists to an internal conflict, in my opinion. The interviewer asks, I want to ask about something you alluded to earlier. For many artists, particularly ones who have been working on the margins, there might be a sense that having success could fill some hole that was there. Like, when I get successful, I will feel different. Did you have those feelings? Gad replies, chasing success can be great for motivating you, but chasing fame, idolatry, and being loved will never answer the question of whether you love yourself. And I'm not saying I do love myself. I love myself a lot more than I did 10 years ago. It's funny. I always thought of myself as a fairly cultured person, but I remember the ending of RuPaul's Drag Race, where he goes, if you can't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love someone else? I'm like, Ru, you're killing me right now. I would watch that and sit uncomfortably in my chair because it's so true. The interviewer asks, I wonder if that connects to what you said earlier about always feeling a hole in the soul. Do you have any clarity about where that hole came from? Gad's response, the big turning point in my life was being sexually abused, groomed. My whole physiology, psychology, sense of self changed dramatically overnight, and I felt completely disconnected from the world. I remember I was in London working at a pub, and I could only ever afford the bus because the tube was too expensive. So I walked everywhere. I remember feeling so disconnected from life, wandering around these streets, and no one ever even looks at you. But if I look back at my life, there was always an insecurity and a kind of listlessness. When I went to university, I remember this cloak of self-consciousness coming over me. I didn't know who to be or what to do, and I probably tried to be several different people before I tried to be myself. So I think that hole in the soul has always been there. The interviewer asks, I went back and read years' worth of interviews with you. And in so many of them, you're so open and soul-bearing and honest. I found myself feeling almost protective of you. And it just makes me want to know. Answer this however honestly you want. How do you feel about yourself these days? Gad's response, I don't know. Better than I did. I'm more settled in myself. I used to be in the constant battle because I couldn't accept certain parts of myself, or I had been through things I couldn't forget, or I was so self-damning. Sometimes I think half the battle in life is thinking that there is some sort of switch where it is all okay, that you can have a click moment in life where you are at peace with yourself and with everyone, and you can wander in a room and you won't care what people think. But life is challenging, and life is hard, and a lot of it is accepting that the struggle will always mutate into different struggles, and it's how you manage those choppy waters. The interviewer asks, I read an interview that you hadn't had same-sex attraction until after your assault. Is that right? Gad's response, yeah, that is true. I know that's a controversial idea. I've never said it's because of that. I'd never say that. I say that perhaps it forced me to look at myself, to re-examine myself. Maybe I was strutting from A to B, expressing myself in such a way that I never looked before. I'm not sure. All I know is that I went through a period, this is radically honest, of almost feeling asexual and then getting very confused and then exploring that and realizing that I'm fine both ways. Even now, I'm still a little bit lost. I do think that abuse of that nature can leave you uncertain in your body. But I'm not saying that abuse makes you gay. My truth, which nobody can take from me, is that I didn't question myself until that happened. The interviewer asks, it seems like a hard one to wrap the head around. Gad's response, absolutely. That's why I always like my shows to be inconsistent in a way. People doing and saying things that aren't necessarily clear. You see coming out things on television, and it's like all the character needs to do is say, I'm gay, and everything is fine. Whereas in reality, it's not about saying it or people knowing. It's about saying to yourself and you knowing. That's a fascinating part of self-acceptance. The interviewer asks, on the idea of working through your experience, is there ever any sense of, I'd actually like to transcend this and be on the other side and onto other things? Gad's response, I suppose I would say that one would hope that I would get to that point. I would hope that one day I do something that's so far removed from me that it feels like some sort of release, like it's not even part of me. If I was to move away, I would have to find some sort of divine peace and spirituality, which feels quite far at the moment, but everything's getting better, so we'll see. End of interview. The Ethicist by Kwame Anthony Appiah. I'm the family breadwinner. Do I have to fund my wife's bad habit? My wife doesn't work, and she depends on me financially. This is an agreement we've had for years, and it works well for both of us. We live comfortably, but on a tight monthly budget. When I met her 10 years ago, she didn't smoke. I know she had smoked before, but she assured me that she had stopped entirely. Some months ago, though, she started smoking again. We talked about it, and I told her my position was that, obviously, she was free to smoke, as long as she did it outside the house, and that the money for her cigarettes would not be included in our budget planning. She would somehow have to find the money somewhere else. I think her smoking is terrible for us as a family, since it increases the chances of her getting sick, and I don't want to have anything to do with that. But it's clear that she resents my position. I've never said no to something she has asked for, and this is creating a division between us. Should I pay for my wife's cigarettes? The response? Your position is easy to grasp. Why should you subsidize this deplorable habit? Step back, though, and consider the basic situation here. Because you earn all the family income, you've taken it on yourself to exercise complete control over it, giving yourself universal veto power over your wife's expenditures. That's a problem, and she has cause to resent your position. You're not treating your wife as a partner. You're not genuinely treating the household earnings as a shared resource. You've left her like a Victorian wife reduced to pawning her earrings for some spending money. Given that presumably she contributes to the household in other ways, including through her labor, it makes sense to treat your earnings as your family's and to give her discretionary income. If she chooses to spend her share on cigarettes, that's her choice. At the same time, you should feel free, as a loving spouse deeply concerned for your wife's welfare, to tell her regularly that you think she should quit. It's just that the subject of the conversation should be her health, not your money. My father stopped smoking at my mother's request. But when he relapsed, she relented, and a smoking-related cancer eventually cut his life short. I wish she'd stuck to her guns. Your wife may one day be grateful that you pushed her to stop smoking. But the way to help her to do so isn't through exploiting your financial leverage. It's through discussing ways to kick the habit. Next question. I have a close friend who recently made a statement about vaccines that is a fringe opinion and, quite frankly, a conspiracy theory. I didn't say anything at the time, but I later texted her to say that her statement was false, and I sent a screenshot of the facts. Given her beliefs, I don't really want to devote more energy to this friendship. Among our history of disagreements, this one may be the straw that broke the camel's back. I had never before brought up my objections to her ideas, because until now, I considered her beliefs inconsequential. But it seems actively dangerous for her to espouse this belief about vaccines. I have trouble treating her patently false belief as a matter of opinion and doing what she calls respecting her decision. I told her I wasn't comfortable hanging out and knowing that she's not vaccinating her children on schedule, given that our kids play together every week. She's upset because she says I'm holding her to a higher standard than I would a stranger. But I think I am well within my reason to do so. She is not a stranger. In fact, we would be more likely to catch something from her family precisely because of how often we get together. She also said my comments about not socializing with her were hurtful. But I don't understand how. If this is her position, she has to understand that friends and family might feel that way. And it's nothing personal. It's a health and safety issue for me and our community. Moreover, it really bothers me that she is selfishly choosing to put her children and others at risk when there is no need to do so. As it stands, we aren't really talking. Our kids see each other much less frequently than before, and I am fine with this. What do you think? Kwame's answer. Your friend is among the many people who have been drawn into vaccine conspiracy theories, often through social media, and mistrust of vaccines has become increasingly correlated with political partisanship. Gallup polling shows Republican support for the importance of childhood vaccinations has dropped significantly over the past decade, while Democratic support has held roughly steady or even increased. Previously, there was little partisan split. So part of your discomfort may be less about measles and more about her views signal politically. What's true is that unvaccinated people are more likely to contract the infectious diseases that haven't been protected against and to spread them, including to those who have been vaccinated, because no vaccine offers 100% protection. When you get vaccinated, you do two things at once. You lower your own risk and you contribute to herd immunity, the collective protection that kicks in once enough of the population is covered. That's why anti-vaxxers have, for such a long time, been able to free ride on that majority. It's a real problem for public health, as regional immunization rates have dropped below a safe level, and the incidence of measles in particular has risen because vaccine opposition has risen. But the arithmetic cuts the other way for your immediate situation. If you and your children are vaccinated, your personal exposure to an unvaccinated family is raising your extremely low risk to one that, in absolute terms, is still extremely low. The diseases that once struck hundreds of thousands of Americans annually, measles, mumps, rubella, are still rare enough that the actual danger to your kids from this friendship is remote. Should your friend's family be connected to a measles outbreak, obviously, it's a different story. If this friendship were otherwise worth keeping, I'd worry less about your family's health than about hers. Your friend objects that you're penalizing her for something a stranger could get away with, that you're knowing her situation is being held against her. This is just how social life works, though. We hold people we're acquainted with to standards that can't apply to a stranger because we actually know what they're doing. And you can make a public-minded argument in favor of the penalty, which is that ostracism can be a general deterrent, genuine deterrent. Arguing someone out of a conspiracy theory is hard. You might think that a social cost attached to the belief could do more work than logic would. On the other hand, there's also a democratic case for staying in conversation with people whose views you find wrong or even dangerous. It's unhealthy for democratic self-governance when we disconnect over disagreement. Vaccine hesitancy among Republicans grew sharply during a period when Americans sorted themselves into increasingly insular partisan networks. Sealed social networks, a process of mutual ostracism, allow misinformation to go unchallenged. You lose the kind of friction that comes from having to defend your views to someone who doesn't share them. Remaining friends with your anti-vaxxer gives you a chance to change her mind, at the cost, admittedly, of having to hear her try to change yours. But the facts really are on your side, and the work of persuasion matters in the aggregate. Measles had zero reported cases in the United States in 2000, a triumph of herd immunity, we're now slowly squandering. Getting back there requires vaccination rates above 95%. Which requires winning over people like your friend. It's hard to do that once you've walked away. Even when the argument fails, having it as part of what it means to govern together. Democratic governance thrives when we treat each other as people still worth persuading. I've been making the point that you don't have to break up with this woman simply for public-minded reasons. I should have also acknowledged that a friendship you stick with simply for public-minded reasons isn't much of a friendship at all. If you don't much value this relationship, and your letter suggests you don't, you're free to let it go. Improv by Nikolaya Rips. You are born alone, you die alone, and you manually enter your credit card details into the comedy school website alone. That's what I told myself when, shortly after my 27th birthday, I signed up for an improv class. I had been feeling anxious and indecisive. It leaked out of me in different ways. I spent nights clobbering myself for past mistakes. When asked to speak publicly at panels or literary readings, I would subject myself to a grueling preparation, practicing until the words dissolved in my mouth. Around me, my closest companions were getting engaged, moving to other countries, progressing in their careers. While I was so afraid of making a mistake that would damage my future irreparably that I couldn't choose between chicken or shrimp at lunch. If all the world's a stage, then I had stage fright. My friends suggested therapy, but my insurance didn't cover it. I decided on improv. Modern comedic improvisation, which happened to be developed around the same time as exposure therapy. But what better way to get over decision paralysis than total immersion, squaring off with the unknown for 3 hours a week? It wasn't doctor-ordered, but self-prescribed. The thing was, I had never particularly enjoyed improv. I often found it unfunny, and I held the snooty writer's belief that if you were going to inflict your work on others, you had better sit yourself down and edit. But maybe the real fear was simpler. What if I couldn't hack it? I signed up for a beginner course that ran 8 weeks. I had recently started a full-time job, so the only time slot I could manage was 7 to 10 on Monday nights. During the coldest New York winter in 8 years, as I walked to Soho, where the class was held, I felt sweat seeping through my socks. I realized I was voluntarily stepping into the very maw of humiliation. The class was on the second floor of an icy Italianate office building, and the room had padded walls. There was no cell phone service. Our instructor, a veteran comic, was about 6'3", far taller than the rest of us, imparting an instant feeling of submission. He led us through a few games. Games in improv aren't games in the traditional sense, because there's no possibility of winning. Some have names like Big Booty and Synchronized Clapping. Most remain nameless. An example? Two people gradually build a scene using identities and locations and situations. First, someone might say, I'm a rat. Then, well, I'm a chef. Then, I'm trying to escape, followed by, and I'm trying to kill you. Around the middle of the course, we were introduced to what was called the game. Different improv schools have different teaching styles, but the game is the heart of the practice. It is the conceit of a scene. The central intrigue, the organizing gimmick, the joke, and you have to find it. In order to do that, you must be completely present with your thoughts and those of your partner. Instead of trying to kill the rat, say, maybe you are apologizing to the rat because you didn't mean to forget your anniversary. The game is then that the rat and the chef are dating. This is a bad joke, sure, but the point is that being bad is better than being boring. Decisions are supposed to be quick. They propel you forward into more exciting decisions. You must always respond to your partner's offering with, yes, and. Because of the late hours of the class, my troupe was largely made of people with busy days. They were recent divorcees, hospital workers, mothers. But who we were in the confines of reality was unimportant. One woman had an absolute mastery over physical comedy, while another told us that she practiced accents in the mirror every night. Someone could do a Candace Owens impression on command. Another was Dorothy Parker quick. Every Monday, I dragged myself to improv, and every Monday night, I skipped home, ribs aching from giggling. Then came the holidays. I missed a class, then another, and another. I became convinced that I had simply missed too much improv to continue. I already was terrified of the expansive nothingness of our enterprise. Now, suddenly, everybody else knew much more about that nothingness than I did. My traitorous mind offered the solution. Just quit. But I went anyway. The class had indeed progressed from little games to proper scene work. But the instructor still called on me to do a scene. How could I possibly succeed, I thought, if I still didn't really know how to do improv? up there with everyone watching, finally liberated from the idea of creating something good, I actually did. I quickly found the game with my scene partner, which happened to be a vague impression of my mom trying to use AI. I heard laughter, and then it was over. The instructor looked at me beatifically. He seemed to be saying, with his eyes, knowingly, "You idiot, you've been doing improv this whole time." The reason you can't win an improv game, I realized, is because there are no correct answers. The only time you fail is when you avoid making a decision at all. The wrong choices are often the funniest. It's walking off the plank. After confronting your lifelong fear of drowning and finding yourself in the kiddie pool. With improv, I shed the burden of expecting the universe to provide a perfect answer to my imperfect life. I'd have chicken for lunch today. Yes, and shrimp tomorrow. One Last Run by Blair Braverman. Mushing, blurs what it means to be wild. One night, my sled dogs and I were gliding through a birch forest in Wisconsin when a black wolf emerged from the trees and ran beside us. None of the dogs even barked. They treated him as a peer, which unnerved me. The eye contact they made. If my dogs related to the wolf and I to them, then what did that make me? Another time, in Saskatchewan, a wolf followed us for 100 miles. I never saw it move. But each time I turned around, it stood in the trail with its chin high. We were 11 of us then, crossing a chain of frozen lakes, and wind blew hard across the ice. The trail was blown smooth. Sometimes the dog stepped off its edges and stumbled, neck deep in the fluff. Or my sled caught the lip and flipped onto its side. It was so cold, 30 below zero, and the wind made it colder. My legs grew numb below the knees, and the dog's fur lifted in waves. At night, the aura cast a pearly, shifting glow over the landscape. I'd turn sometimes, look back, and sure enough, there was the wolf, always standing, watching, at the edge of my headlamp's beam. It was chasing our crumbs, I think. I gave each dog frozen chicken thigh every hour, and when they chewed, they left chips of meat in the snow. I fell in love with mushing almost 2 decades ago, when I was 18. I wanted to run expeditions, mushing long distances on our own, camping out in the snow. It's an ancient way to cross the north, and it feels ancient. A way of stepping into timelessness for as long as the trip lasts. Still, the sport has evolved. 100 years ago, trappers and mail carriers traversed the ungroomed routes and well-muscled dogs, and hunters hauled seals and walruses home by sled. It wasn't until the rise of long-distance racing in the 1970s, an effort to revive sled dog culture after snowmobiles made subsistence mushing obsolete, that dog teams grew longer and the dogs lighter and faster. These days, most sled dogs are Alaskan Huskies, a fancy name for northern breed mutts with a yearning to pull and a dash of hound for speed. I never intended to race, but a musher I worked for was racing anyway, and he lent me his extra team. Later, when my husband learned to mush and we got our own dogs, he liked planning for races, making measurable goals, and he encouraged me to compete. I won a 2-day race against 20-odd teams in my second season, and peaked in the top five in two major marathons, the 300-mile Canadian Challenge. That year was a 40-below ordeal that half of my competitors didn't complete. And the infamous Kobuk, which crosses 440 miles of wind-pummeled Arctic terrain. I wasn't a natural racer. I sought adventure more than speed. But I had two main strengths. Like the dogs, I didn't quit. And I was efficient at checkpoints, those camps or villages en route where teams can rest and resupply. I could churn through tasks, making straw beds for the dogs, taking off their booties, lighting the methanol cooker, melting snow, thawing meat, doling out stew, tucking the dogs under blankets, massaging their muscles, then repeating those steps in reverse with little or no sleep myself before mushing another 40 miles down the trail and doing it all again and again. Checkpoints are where most mushers lose time, even if their dogs are fast. The sleeping bag's too enticing, and the booty's ice-encrusted Velcro gets stuck to itself when your hands are fumbling cold. For a while, my racing career, like a dog sled, went only one direction. I entered longer events each season. 7 years back, I lived in a dry cabin in Alaska, 60 miles from the nearest neighbor or road, and finished the 1,000-mile Iditarod, a colossal journey over the Alaska Range, up the frozen Yukon River, and across ice on the Bering Sea. On my first try, when the dogs and I reached Trail's End in the tiny city of Nome, the bustling world was too much. I wanted to turn around where they and I could be alone. Winters passed, my race dogs grew old, as dogs do, as people do, and retired one by one to gentler lifestyles, adventures more their speed. Their pups and grandpups, passionate and green, took their places on the line. And then, last spring, at the end of the season, my husband and I separated. We'd been through fire, running successive Iditarods, spending years in a one-room cabin with no plumbing, and 30 dogs, training the race team, a Herculean task, together. In losing him, losing the witness to my life, I felt our years together becoming less real, flattened into one human memory instead of two. That's the thing about divorce. You're losing not just the future you pictured, but also the past as you knew it. Now he has most of the dogs. After an all-consuming decade, my racing career crashed suddenly to a stop. So I began this past winter with a vision to gather my still living retirees and return to the wilderness together. They're old, so we wouldn't go far. Just a 2-day trip at the top of Minnesota. As I and they face retirement from racing, I hope they would teach me how to move on. I hope they knew that we would always be a team. So many times in the hottest moments, I've wished Pepe could lead my life as she does the team. Pressed my face into her neck, begged, "What do I do?" She never answers. She just sits straighter and looks away. As a lead dog running in front of the others, Pepe's job is to guide the team. Where she goes, the other dogs follow. And eventually I, swinging behind them on a sled with no steering and only a metal claw that scrapes snow as a suggestion of a brake, follow too. A musher is like a water skier behind the boat, making requests he cannot possibly enforce. For this reason, the relationship between musher and lead dog is intimate and intense. Each time I call directions to Pepe, Guy and Haw for right and left, or on by, or straight ahead, or whoa, It's with the understanding that she will comply only if she agrees. And she will agree only to the extent that she regards me as competent and useful. I prove my use by learning and anticipating her needs. I lose credibility by doing silly things like crying into the fur of her neck. Emotion embarrasses Pepe. She is stoic and really wags. When she expresses excitement, it's generally for work alone. I have a recurring insecurity that she doesn't like me very much. Who could blame her? She's cooler than I'll ever be. I can't count the storms she has led me through, glancing back with a look of simultaneous exasperation and pride before veering hard down some unmarked trail that happens, of course, to be the shortcut home. In the Kobuk on sea ice, she muscled through a ground blizzard as the wind whipped fallen snow into a blinding haze. At the finish line, a former Iditarod champion asked to buy her for $5,000 on the spot. After that race, the other dogs and I rode in a snowmobile trailer around the Kotzebue, a village in Alaska. Pepe, who had just run 440 miles in 3 days, refused to ride with us. Instead, she kept pace, miraculously, with the machine. White paws swinging in an impossible fast trot, ears flapping and eyes half closed against the ice wind. Pepe hasn't officially retired. At almost 13, her body has slowed, but she still trained with my ex for much of the winter, joining every one run she could. But she will, naturally, be leading this trip, along with six of her old peers. Colbert, the eldest, came from champion lines, sold from team to team, until a friend offered him to me for free. And though I wasn't looking for a dog, I saw his shaggy face, and I fell in love. I had a low top speed, falling back. He had a low top speed, falling back when lighter dogs broke into a lope. But he was always first to his feet, barking to run, no matter how short the break. And man, can he eat. An asset for sled dogs who, despite marathon workouts that burn more than 10,000 calories at a time, don't always care for food. Pepe unnervingly takes hunger strikes that last for days. Once, 900 miles into a race, I woke from a nap to find Colbert grinning stupidly and discovered that he'd sneaked into my sled and eaten 10 pounds of frozen chicken skin while I slept. We put him on a bush plane to finish the line because he was too full to run. Spike and Clem are littermates, brothers, sons of Pepe, both 9. They're handsome to a fault, square-jawed and robust. Clem tumbled through puppyhood, slow and round, and found his athleticism with age. He has an unshakable good cheer and obsession with scratches on the rump. Spike was the beast of the litter, a jock from day one. He never waited for milk. He simply plowed through his siblings, knocking them aside. Now he lows like a cow at small discomforts, like when I work a burr from his fur. Spike and Clem, though, they've chilled with age. Were cutthroat nemesis for years. I ran their sister Willow between them to keep the peace. Willow is a plain brown, big for a girl, with the kind of wide-eyed innocence that makes you forget how good she is at raiding your pocket for snacks. She loves breaking trail, though, breaking trail through powder, and is, like her brothers, a cuddler. She'll ram her head right into your chest. Her daughter, Dora, is the youngest here, and still races sometimes. But at 7, middle-aged, she's lost the freneticism of her youth. She's brilliant, desperate to please. but used to be too energetic to sit or stay on command. For her first 3 years, every picture I took of her was blurred. When Dora was spayed and needed rest to heal, I put her in a bunk in the dog truck because she liked it more than a crate. An hour later, she'd gnawed out, her head stuck through the truck's wall with a maniacal smile. Even being spayed couldn't stop her. Years later, she gave birth to two puppies anyway, which seemed like a very Dora thing to do. Bodica, 11, is Pepe's half-sister and a lead dog herself. She gives creepy, endearing kisses. She pushes her snout into your eyeball, then extends the warm tip of her tongue. Years ago, Bodica was attacked by another dog, and when I couldn't pull them apart, I threw my body over hers to shield her. Felt her trembling beneath me, the other snarling above. This desperate move, plus emergency treatment, helped Bodica pull through. Later that year, a Jack Russell bit me in the face. He had jumped at my dinner plate, and I, accustomed to sled dogs, growled to warm him away. That doesn't work with terriers. Another musher gave me 9 stitches in the mouth by headlamp. Bodica and I recuperated together. We both still have our scars. I'd wake at night to find her forehead pressed on mine. For this reunion trip, I'm mushing from Chili Dogs, a retirement kennel for racing sled dogs in Ely, Minnesota, that is run by my friend Jake H-way. His wife, Jess, and their 4 ultra-competent kids. It's where many of my older dogs now live. The kennel's concept is simple. When sled dogs slow down at 8 or 9 or 11, they can get discouraged. They feel bad about not keeping up with their friends. Then they come to Chili Dogs, where they are the youngest, and get a new lease on life, pulling tourists at their own pace and teaching scouts how to mush in the nearby Boundary Waters Canoe Area wilderness. The place is cacophonous, a sea of play wrestling and wagging tails, but I try to stay focused, packing my sled with gear and straw and meat. It feels good to gather the team. Pepe scouts the trail while I prep Colbert, pulling the harness snug up on his thick chest. Clem pushes his head against my cheek. When the dogs are hooked up, they jump and wail, desperate to start the run. I grip the sled hard and untie the rope that holds them back. Then the dogs surge. The sled yanks me forward, and we're flowing down a narrow trail through ice-glazed aspen and black spruce. There's the sound of breath, the hish of the runners, the sled rattling slightly over bumps. It's just afternoon, but we're north, so the sun hangs low. The trees cast blue stripes on the golden snow. I always get a rush of adrenaline at the start of a run. It's the shift in control from myself to the dogs, the fact that they're stronger than I am, and we're entering wilderness, and my influence on the trip's outcome is largely determined by their grace. But this time my nerves dissolve fast. I know them so well. Spike's fur poking up through his harness, Bodica's bouncing right ear. That being a team, tied together and moving fast, is like returning into my own body. I feel their movements through the sled, passing into my fingers, my feet. New mushers are shocked, always, by a dog team's power. This power feels like mine. Colbert is slack, his tug line bouncing behind him, and I ride the sled brake with one heel, slowing the team to his pace. Normally, dogs don't wag while they run. They're too focused. But his tail half lifts, scraggly tip circling away, Including him means we can't run far, but maybe 5 miles instead of 30, which is itself much shorter than the 100-mile days these dogs ran at their peak. But I can't leave him, not when he wants to come. How many hours have I watched that shaggy back lope up the trail? How many hours do I have left? In lead, Pepe and her granddaughter, Dora, set the pace in unison, a perfect copy-paste. They're both dark gray, catching a light, and though I know their gaits, their tails, the rhythm of their ears, who slows down to bite snow, who's prone to looking back, and who wants to flirt with passing teams, whose fur gets stickier in the frost, I think, watching grandmother and granddaughter together, that if it weren't for the stripe of white on Pepe's head, flashing up as she bounds, I wouldn't be certain who was who. Now Pepe glances down to the right, and I see shadows in the snow ahead, wolf tracks, crossing the trail before forking to the left. Her gait doesn't change, but her eyes follow, and she turns her chin to the side. I graze my foot on the brake, sending a minuscule twang through the line. Pepe's head snaps forward. She thought of chasing the tracks. Now she won't. The rest of the dogs don't even know. But there are more spoor ahead. 3, 4, and soon the others notice. 2. Spike's gait, normally so smooth, jolts as he sniffs the snow. Clem spurs from a trot to a run. The wolves were just here. Jake snowmobiled the trail this morning. The prints crossed over his tracks. The smell of wolves excites the dogs. They want to run faster, but Colbert is getting tired. He lumbers, even as I ride the brake. And too quickly, the miles pass. We reach a bog, crusted white with dry grass and cattails poking through the snow. To the east, a small hill covered with alder and pine. Sled dogs, even old ones, Colbert patters his feet when I call. Whoa! I tie the sled to a tamarack so they don't take off without me and start to unload. The rituals of making camp are soothing, especially today. It's unreasonably warm, 30 degrees. My hands are bare and my parkas in the sled along with the mittens I stitch from the fur of 2 beavers that these dogs once ate. I cut the twine on a straw bale, pulling apart the dusty flakes, and shake them into 7 mounds. 6 dogs rearrange the beds, nosing and turning it until the straw feels right. Pepe ignores her mound and makes for the rest of the bale, which she occupies like a throne. The cattails are damp, poor tinder, so I shred birch bark into a fluff and light it with a match. Willow rests her paw on my thigh. I kneel to feed the flame. Spike licks my chin with his massive tongue. Finally, the fire crackles. The orange feathers wrap the logs. I melt snow in a kettle, propping it up on burning wood, and duck when the smoke spins towards me. Once the water bubbles, I add it to beef and kibble, then dole out dishes to the dogs. Colbert's done eating before the others even start. He licks his lips, eyes their steaming bowls. Pepe dumps her meat on the snow, uninterested. For a time, we curl up together, watching the sky turn pink. The fire grows low and air colder. One by one, the dogs sink into sleep, everyone but Pepe. At first, I think she's guarding her meat, standing at the edge of the camp's packed snow, half facing the darkness. I call, patting the straws beside me, but she looks away. Why won't she come near me, and why guard her food when the others are asleep? I wish she'd come over, let me pet her. She's just so damn cool. Pepe, I say, but she doesn't respond. Her chin sinks, and for a moment she bows and stumbles before shaking her head to wake up, as sleepy as I've ever seen her, but she won't lie down. Then a twig cracks, and she meets my eyes. It's okay, I say. Her ears twitch. It's just a bird. Pepe licks her nose. She stares at me with a moment longer, then turns back to the night. Her head sinks again lower, and she snaps it back up. And suddenly I understand. Pepe's not avoiding me. She's working with me. I'm sitting up, so she's sitting up. We're guiding our team together. I've never been good at letting go. Look at the dogs now, sprawled, content, shrouded in frost and breath, and sorrow is punching me in the ribs. I can't bear the thought that it won't last. Dogs' lives pass faster than ours. I've watched them, loved them for generations. Willow, Pepe's daughter, had her own puppies 7 years back. When her labor came, I sat nearby as ripples passed through her fur like waves. Her eyes were closed. Eventually, like a burp, out slid her first. He was huge, round-bellied, brown fur, pebble ears, one dab of a white paw. For a second, I saw him groan, tall and beaver brown, white paw prancing in the snow. Then Willow licked him, and his head fell back. He was steaming warm and dead. Willow pressed her tongue to his face, bracing him with her paw, and pushed him to her belly to drink. He flopped over. She licked harder, frantic. Finally, she lifted him with her mouth, arching her neck. In one movement, she opened her throat and swallowed her baby whole. I could barely breathe. I didn't know what to do. Willow sighed and laid back down. New pulses passed through her. She straightened her tail, and another puppy slid out, gummy with slime, small this time, black and white. This puppy was dead too. No, I said, though I didn't mean to speak. The word just appeared in my voice. Not another dead pup. I wouldn't allow it. I took the puppy from Willow before she could lick it and lifted it to my face, a limp girl, her markings uneven, as if she'd been dipped in the paint. No breath, no heartbeat at all. I didn't know what I was doing, but I did it anyway. With those tiny ribs in my hands, her skin like membrane, I pumped her chest with the flesh of my palms, squeezing fast and light. I covered her snout with my mouth and blew, kept squeezing, blowing, until the puppy coughed. Then I thrust her to Willow's side, where she nursed as Willow gave birth to 8 more puppies, every one of them alive. The next morning, they were all bigger, except for the black and white girl, who had shrunk. I held her to Willow's nipple, but she wouldn't drink. I offered formula in a syringe. It dribbled from her mouth. I warmed her under my shirt, but she stayed cool. In 3 days, she died again, and that time she didn't come back. I thought of that puppy a lot, wondering if it was right to revive her, if there was cruelty in my refusal to let go. We both had our ways of facing grief, Willow and I, and maybe Willow knew the best, keeping her boy inside her where he belonged.